Christian has certainty all the way through. It is a violation of Sharia. But if there is a weak form of asymmetry, say, someone has inside information which gives an edge in the markets, there is no gerar, as there remains enough uncertainty for both parties, given that the price is in the future and only God knows the future. Selling a defective product, where there is certainty as to the defect, on the other hand, is illegal. So the knowledge by the seller of corn in Rhodes in my first example does not fall under gerar, while the second case, that of a defective liquid, would. As we see, the problem of asymmetry is so complicated that different schools give different ethical solutions. So let us look at the Talmudic approach. Rav Safra and the Swiss. Jewish ethics on the matter is closer to Antipater than Diogenes in its aims at transparency. Not only should there be transparency concerning the merchandise, but perhaps there has to be transparency concerning what the seller has in mind, what he thinks deep down. The medieval rabbi Shlomo Itzaki, a.k.a. Solomon Isakidis, known as Rashi, relates the following story. Rav Safra, a 3rd-century Babylonian scholar who was also an active trader, was offering some goods for sale. A buyer came as he was praying in silence, tried to purchase the merchandise at an initial price, and given that the rabbi did not reply, raised the price. But Rav Safra had no intention of selling at a higher price than the initial offer, and felt that he had to honor the initial intention. Now the question, is Rav Safra obligated to sell at the initial price, or should he take the improved one? Such total transparency is not absurd and not uncommon in what seems to be a cutthroat world of transactions, my former world of trading. I have frequently faced that problem as a trader and will side in favor of Rav Safra's action in the debate. Let us follow the logic. Recall the rapacity of salespeople earlier in the chapter. Sometimes I would offer something for sale for, say, $5, but communicated with the client through a salesperson, and the salesperson would come back with an improvement of $5.10. Something never felt right about the extra 10 cents. It was, simply, not a sustainable way of doing business. What if the customer subsequently discovered that my initial offer was $5? No compensation is worth the feeling of shame. The overcharge falls in the same category as the act of stuffing people with bad merchandise. Now, to apply this to Rav Safra's story, what if he sold to one client at the marked-up price and to another one the exact same item for the initial price, and the two buyers happened to know one another? What if they were agents for the same customer? It may not be ethically required, but the most effective, shame-free policy is maximal transparency, even transparency of intentions. However, the story doesn't tell us whether the purchaser was a Swiss. Those outsiders our ethical rules don't apply to. I suspect that there would be a species for which our ethical rules would be relaxed or possibly lifted. Recall our discussion of Kant. Theory is too theoretical for humans. The more confined our ethics, the less abstract, the better it works. Otherwise, as we will see with Eleanor Ostrom's result later in this chapter, the system cannot function properly. And before Ostrom, our old friend Friedrich Nietzsche got the point. Sympathy for all would be tyranny for thee, my good neighbor. Nietzsche, by the way, is the one person Fat Tony, upon hearing his quotes, said he would never debate. Members and non-members. For the exclusion of the Swiss from our ethical realm is not trivial. Things don't scale and generalize, which is why I have trouble with intellectuals talking about abstract notions. A country is not a large city, a city is not a large family, and sorry, the world is not a large village. There are scale transformations we will discuss here and in the appendix of Book 3. When Athenians treat all opinions equally and discuss democracy, they only apply it to their citizens, not slaves or metics, the equivalent of green card or H-1B visa holders. Effectively, Theodosius's code deprived Roman citizens who married barbarians of their legal rights, hence ethical parity with others. They lost their club membership. As to Jewish ethics, it distinguishes between thick blood and thin blood. We are all brothers, but some are more brothers than others. Free citizens in ancient and post-classical societies were traditionally part of clubs, with rules and member behavior similar to those in today's country clubs, with an inside and an outside. As club members know, the very purpose of a club is exclusion and size limitation. Spartans could hunt and kill helots, those non-citizens with the status of slaves, for training, but they were otherwise equal to other Spartans and expected to die for the sake of Sparta. The large cities in the pre-Christian ancient world, particularly in the Levant and Asia Minor, were full of fraternities and clubs, open and often secret societies. There was even such a thing as funeral clubs, where members shared the costs and participated in the ceremonials of funerals. Today's Roma people, aka gypsies, have tons of strict rules of behavior toward gypsies, and others toward the unclean non-gypsies called paios. And, as the anthropologist David Graeber has observed, even the investment bank Goldman Sachs, known for its aggressive cupidity, acts like a communist community from within, thanks to the partnership system of governance. So we exercise our ethical rules, but there is a limit, from scaling, beyond which the rules cease to apply. It is unfortunate, but the general kills the particular. The question we will re-examine later, after deeper discussion of complexity theory, is whether it is possible to be both ethical and universalist. In theory, yes, but, sadly, not in practice. For whenever the we becomes too large a club, things degrade, and each one starts fighting for his own interest. The abstract is way too abstract for us. This is the main reason I advocate political systems that start with a municipality and work their way up. Ironically, as in Switzerland, those Swiss, rather than the reverse, which has failed with larger states. Being somewhat tribal is not a bad thing, and we have to work in a fractal way in the organized, harmonious relations between tribes, rather than merge all tribes in one large soup. In that sense, an American-style federalism is the ideal system. This scale transformation from the particular to the general is behind my skepticism about unfettered globalization and large centralized multi-ethnic states. The physicist and complexity researcher Yanir Bar-Yam showed quite convincingly that better fences make better neighbors, something both policymakers and local governments fail to get about the Near East. Scaling matters, I will keep repeating until I get hoarse. Putting Shiites, Christians, and Sunnis in one pot and asking them to sing Kumbaya around the campfire while holding hands in the name of unity and fraternity of mankind has failed. Interventionistas aren't yet aware that should is not a sufficiently empirically valid statement to build nations. Blaming people for being sectarian instead of making the best of such a natural tendency is one of the stupidities of interventionistas. Separate tribes for administrative purposes, as the Ottomans did, or just put some markers somewhere, and they suddenly become friendly to one another. Even then, the Ottomans did not go far enough in granting autonomy. Some argue that had Armenians heeded the call by the novelist Rafi for additional autonomy, the tragedies of the 1890s and 1915 would have been mitigated. The Levant has suffered, and keeps suffering, from Western, usually Anglo-Saxon, Arabists, enamored with their subject, with no skin in the game in the place, who somehow have a vicious mission to destroy local indigenous cultures and languages, and separate the Levant from its Mediterranean roots. The head of the Arab League, one Amr Musa, was horrified at a lecture I gave outlining the notion that good fences make better neighbors. He was offended by my message promoting sectarianism. The common strategy by the Sunni-dominant majority in Arabic-speaking countries has been to call any attempt by a group to establish some autonomy sectarianism. Ironically, these people, when rich, often have houses in Switzerland. It is always convenient to invoke universalism when you are in the majority. Since they are good at labels, they also accuse you of racism if, like the Kurds, Maronites, and Copts, you make any remote claim about self-rule. The term racism has undergone some devaluation, as it can be funny to observe Iraqis and Kurds calling one another racist for both wanting and opposing Kurdish self-determination. But we don't have to go very far to get the importance of scaling. You know instinctively that people get along better as neighbors than roommates. When you think about this, it is obvious, even trite, from the well-known behavior of crowds in the anonymity of big cities compared to groups in small villages. I spend some time in my ancestral village, where it feels like a family. People attend others' funerals, funeral clubs were mostly for large cities, help out, and care about the neighbor, even if they hate his dog. There is no way you can get the same cohesion in a larger city when the other is a theoretical entity, and our behavior toward him or her is governed by some general ethical rule, not someone in flesh and blood. We get it easily when seen that way, but fail to generalize that ethics is something fundamentally local. Now, what's the reason? Modernity put it in our heads that there are two units, the individual and the universal collective. In that sense, skin in the game for you would be just for you as a unit. In reality, my skin lies in a broader set of people, one that includes a family, a community, a tribe, a fraternity. But it cannot possibly be the universal. Non mihi non tibi sed nobis. Neither mine nor yours, but ours. Let us get into the gut of Ostrom's idea. The tragedy of the commons, as exposed by economists, is as follows. The commons being a collective property, say, a forest or fishing waters or your local public park. Collectively, farmers as a community prefer to avoid overgrazing, and fishermen overfishing. The entire resource becomes thus degraded. But every single individual farmer would personally gain from his own overgrazing or overfishing under, of course, the condition that others don't. And that is what plagues socialism. People's individual interests do not quite work well under collectivism. But it is a critical mistake to think that people can function only under a private property system. What Ostrom found empirically is that there exists a certain community size below which people act as collectivists, protecting the commons, as if the entire unit became rational. Such a commons cannot be too large. It is like a club. Groups behave differently at a different scale. This explains why the municipal is different from the national. It also explains how tribes operate. You are part of a specific group that is larger than the narrow you, but narrower than humanity in general. Critically, people share some things but not others within a specified group. And there is a protocol for dealing with the outside. Arab pastoral tribes have firm rules of hospitality toward non-hostile strangers who don't threaten their commons, but get violent when the stranger is a threat. The skin-in-the-game definition of a commons, a space in which you are treated by others the way you treat them, where everyone exercises the silver rule. The public good is something abstract, taken out of a textbook. We will see further in Chapter 19 that the individual is an ill-defined entity. Me is more likely to be a group than a single person. Are you on the diagonal? A saying by the brothers Jeff and Vince Graham summarizes the ludicrousness of scale-free political universalism. I am, at the Fed level, libertarian. At the state level, Republican. At the local level, Democrat. And at the family and friends level, a socialist. If that saying doesn't convince you of the fatuousness of left versus right labels, nothing will. The Swiss are obsessive about governance, and indeed their political system is neither left nor right, but governance-based. The thoughtful mathematician Hans Gersbach once organized a workshop on skin in the game in Zurich on how to properly reward and punish politicians whose interests are not lined up with those of the people they represent. It struck me that if things worked well in Switzerland and other Germanic countries, it is not because of accountability so much as scaling, which makes them very prone to accountability. Germany is a federation. Let us next generalize to risk sharing. All, literally, in the same boat. Greek is a language of precision. It has a word describing the opposite of risk transfer, risk sharing. Synkinden io means taking risks together, which was a requirement in maritime transactions. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Shakespeare, Henry V. The Acts of the Apostles describes a voyage of St. Paul on a cargo ship from Sidon to Crete to Malta. As they hit a storm, when they had eaten what they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the corn overboard into the sea. Now, while they jettisoned particular goods, all owners were to be proportioned the costs of the lost merchandise, not just the specific owners of the lost merchandise. For it turned out that they were following a practice that dates to at least 800 BC, codified in Lex Rhodia, Rhodian law, after the mercantile Aegean island of Rhodes. The code is no longer extant, but has been cited since antiquity. It stipulates that the risks and costs for contingencies are to be incurred equally, with no concern for responsibility. Justinian's code summarizes it. It is provided by the Rhodian law that where merchandise is thrown overboard for the purpose of lightening a ship, what has been lost for the benefit of all must be made up by the contribution of all. And the same mechanism for risk-sharing took place with caravans along desert routes. If merchandise was stolen or lost, all merchants had to split the costs, not just its owner. Cinque Denio has been translated into Latin by maestro classicist Armand Dangour as Comparacletor. Hence, if it ever makes it into English, it should be Comparaclite, and its opposite, the Bob Rubin risk transfer, will be Incomparaclite. But I guess risk-sharing will do in the meanwhile. Next, we discuss some distortions from the introduction of Skin in the Game. Talking One's Book. I went on television once to announce a newly published book and got stuck in the studio, drafted to become part of a roundtable with two journalists plus the anchor. The topic of the day was Microsoft, a company that was in existence at the time. Everyone, including the anchor, chipped in. My turn came. I own no Microsoft stock. I am short no Microsoft stock, i.e., would benefit from its decline. Hence, I can't talk about it. I repeated my dictum of Prologue 1. Don't tell me what you think. Tell me what you have in your portfolio. There was immeasurable confusion in the faces. A journalist is typically not supposed to talk about stocks he owns, and, what is worse, is supposed to always, always make pronouncements about stuff he can barely find on a map. A journalist is meant to be an impartial judge, yet, unlike Sesamnes in the Judgment of Cambyses, there is no threat of a secondary use of his skin. There are two types of talking one's book. One consists of buying a stock because you like it, then commenting on it, and disclosing such ownership. The most reliable advocate for a product is its user. Users of products are more reliable because of a natural filtering. I bought an electric car, a Tesla, because my neighbor was enthusiastic about his, Skin in the Game, and I watched him remain so for a few years. No amount of advertising will match the credibility of a genuine user. Another is buying a stock so you can advertise the qualities of the company, then selling it, benefiting from the trumpeting. This is called market manipulation, and it is certainly a conflict of interest. We removed the skin in the game of journalists in order to prevent market manipulation, thinking that it would be a net gain to society. The arguments in this book are that the former, market manipulation, and conflicts of interest are more benign than impunity for bad advice. The main reason, we will see, is that in the absence of skin in the game, journalists will imitate, to be safe, the opinion of other journalists, thus creating monoculture and collective mirages. In general, skin in the game comes with conflict of interest. What I hope this book will do is show that the former is more important than the latter. There is no problem if people have a conflict of interest, if it is congruous with downside risk for themselves. A short visit to the doctor's office. The doctor doesn't have the Antaeus problem. Medicine, while wrapping the garment of science around it, is fundamentally apprenticeship-based and, like engineering, grounded in experience, not just experimentation and theories. While economists say, assume that, and produce some weird theory, doctors have none of that. So there is skin in the game at many degrees, except perhaps not fully in the agency effect separating customer from provider. And attempts at putting skin in the game there have brought a certain class of adverse effects in shifting uncertainty from the doctor to the patient. The legal system and regulatory measures are likely to put the skin of the doctor in the wrong game. How? The problem resides in the reliance on metrics. Every metric is gameable. The cholesterol lowering we mentioned in Prologue 1 is a metric gaming technique taken to its limit. More realistically, say a cancer doctor or hospital is judged by the 5-year survival rates of patients and needs to face a variety of modalities for a new patient. What choice of treatment would they elect to do? There's a trade-off between laser surgery, a precise surgical procedure, and radiation therapy, which is toxic to both patient and cancer. Statistically, laser surgery may have worse 5-year outcomes than radiation therapy, but the latter tends to create second tumors in the longer run and offers comparatively reduced 20-year disease-specific survival. Given that the window used for the calculation of patient survival is 5 years, not 20, the incentive is to shoot for radiation. So the doctor is likely to be in the process of shifting uncertainty away from him or her by electing the second best option. A doctor is pushed by the system to transfer risk from himself to you, and from the present into the future, or from the immediate future into a more distant future. You need to remember that when you visit a medical office, you will be facing someone who, in spite of his authoritative demeanor, is in a fragile situation. He is not you, not a member of your family, so he has no direct emotional loss should your health experience a degradation. His objective is, naturally, to avoid a lawsuit, something that can prove disastrous to his career. Some metrics can actually kill you. Now, say you happen to visit a cardiologist and turn out to be in the mild risk category, something that doesn't really raise your risk of a cardiovascular event, but precedes the stage of a possibly worrisome condition. There is a strong nonlinearity. A person classified as pre-diabetic or pre-hypertensive is, in probability space, 90% closer to a normal person than to one with the condition. But the doctor is pressured to treat you to protect himself. Should you drop dead a few weeks after the visit, a low-probability event, the doctor can be sued for negligence for not having prescribed the right medicine that is temporarily believed to be useful, as in the case of statins, but that we now know has been backed up by suspicious or incomplete studies. Deep down, he may know that statins are harmful, as they will lead to long-term side effects, but the pharmaceutical companies have managed to convince everyone that these unseen consequences are harmless, when the right precautionary approach is to consider the unseen as potentially harmful. In fact, for most people, except those that are very ill, the risks outweigh the benefits. Except that the long-term medical risks are hidden. They will play out in the long run, whereas the legal risk is immediate. This is no different from the Bob Rubin risk transfer trade of delaying risks and making them look invisible. Now, can one make medicine less asymmetric? Not directly. The solution, as I have argued in Antifragile and more technically elsewhere, is for the patient to avoid treatment when he or she is mildly ill, but use medicine for the tail events, that is, for rarely encountered severe conditions. The problem is that the mildly ill represent a much larger pool of people than the severely ill, and are people who are expected to live longer and consume drugs for longer. Hence, pharmaceutical companies have an incentive to focus on them. Dead people, I am told, stop taking drugs. In sum, both the doctor and the patient have skin in the game, though not perfectly, but administrators don't, and they seem to be the cause of the troubling malfunctioning of the system. Administrators everywhere on the planet, in all businesses and pursuits, and at all times in history, have been the plague. Next. This chapter introduced us to the agency problem and risk-sharing, seen from both a commercial and an ethical viewpoint, assuming the two can be disentangled. We also introduced the problem of scale. Next, we will try to get deeper into the hidden asymmetries that make aggregates strange animals. Book 3. That Greatest Asymmetry. Chapter 2. The Most Intolerant Wins, the Dominance of the Stubborn Minority. Why You Don't Have to Smoke in the Smoking Section. Your Food Choices on the Fall of the Saudi King. How to Prevent a Friend from Working Too Hard. Omar Sharif's Conversion. How to Make a Market Collapse. The main idea behind complex systems is that the ensemble behaves in ways not predicted by its components. The interactions matter more than the nature of the units. Studying individual ants will almost never give us a clear indication of how the ant colony operates. For that, one needs to understand an ant colony as an ant colony, no less, no more, not a collection of ants. This is called an emergent property of the whole, by which parts and whole differ, because what matters are the interactions between such parts, and interactions can obey very simple rules. The rule we discuss in this chapter is the minority rule, the mother of all asymmetries. It suffices for an intransigent minority, a certain type of intransigent minority, with significant skin in the game, or better, soul in the game, to reach a minutely small level, say 3 or 4% of the total population, for the entire population to have to submit to their preferences. Further, an optical illusion comes with the dominance of the minority. A naive observer, who looks at the standard average, would be under the impression that the choices and preferences are those of the majority. If it seems absurd, it is because our scientific intuitions aren't calibrated for this. Forget about scientific and academic intuitions and snap judgments. They don't work, and your standard intellectualization fails with complex systems, though your grandmother's wisdom doesn't. Among other things, many other things, the minority rule will show us how all it takes is a small number of intolerant, virtuous people with skin in the game, in the form of courage, for society to function properly. This example of complexity hit me, ironically, as I was helping with the New England Complex Systems Institute summer barbecue. As the hosts were setting up the table and unpacking the drinks, a friend who was observant and ate only kosher dropped by to say hello. I offered him a glass of that type of yellow sugared water with citric acid people sometimes call lemonade, almost certain that he would reject it owing to his dietary laws. He didn't. He drank the liquid, and another kosher person commented, "Around here, drinks are kosher." We looked at the carton container. There was a fine print, a tiny symbol, a U inside a circle, indicating that it was kosher. The symbol will be detected by those who need to know and look for the minuscule print. As for myself, like the character in Molière's play La Bourgeoise Gentilhomme, who suddenly discovers that he has been speaking in prose all these years without knowing it, I realized that I had been drinking kosher liquids without knowing it. Criminals with peanut allergies. A strange idea hit me. The kosher population represents less than 0.3% of the residents of the United States. Yet, it appears that almost all drinks are kosher. Why? Simply because going full kosher allows the producers, grocers, and restaurants to not have to distinguish between kosher and non-kosher for liquids, with special markers, separate aisles, separate inventories, different stocking sub-facilities. And the simple rule that changes the total is as follows. A kosher or halal eater will never eat non-kosher or non-halal food, but a non-kosher eater isn't banned from eating kosher. Or, rephrased in another domain, a disabled person will not use the regular bathroom, but a non-disabled person will use the bathroom for disabled people. Granted, sometimes in practice we hesitate to use a bathroom with a disabled sign on it owing to some confusion, mistaking the rule for the one for parking cars, believing that the bathroom is reserved for exclusive use by the handicapped. Someone with a peanut allergy will not eat products that touch peanuts, but a person without such an allergy can eat items with peanut traces in them. Which explains why it is so hard to find peanuts on U.S. airplanes, and why schools are often peanut-free, which, in a way, increases the number of persons with peanut allergies, as reduced exposure is one of the causes behind such allergies. Let us apply the rule to domains where it can get entertaining. An honest person will never commit criminal acts, but a criminal will readily engage in legal acts. Let us call such a minority an intransigent group, and the majority a flexible one, and their relationship rests on an asymmetry in choices. I once pulled a prank on a friend. Years ago, when Big Tobacco was hiding and repressing the evidence of harm from secondary smoke, New York had smoking and non-smoking sections in restaurants. Even airplanes had, absurdly, a smoking section. I once went to lunch with a fellow visiting from Europe. The restaurant only had availability in the smoking section. I convinced my visitor that we needed to buy cigarettes, as we had to smoke in the smoking section. He complied. Two more things. First, the geography of the terrain, that is, the spatial structure, matters a bit. It makes a big difference whether the intransigents are in their own district or are mixed with the rest of the population. If people following the minority rule lived in ghettos with a separate small economy, then the minority rule would not apply. But when a population has an even spatial distribution, say, when the ratio of such a minority in a neighborhood is the same as that in the entire village, that in the village it is the same as in the county, that in the county it is the same as in state, and that in the state it is the same as nationwide, then the flexible majority will have to submit to the minority rule. Second, the cost structure matters quite a bit. It happens in our first example that making lemonade compliant with kosher laws doesn't change the price by much. It is a matter of avoiding some standard additives. But if the manufacturing of kosher lemonade costs substantially more, then the rule will be weakened in some non-linear proportion to the difference in costs. If it costs 10 times as much to make kosher food, then the minority rule will not apply, except perhaps in some very rich neighborhoods. Muslims have kosher laws, so to speak, but these are much narrower and apply only to meat. Muslims and Jews have near identical slaughter rules. All kosher is halal for most Sunni Muslims, or was so in past centuries, but the reverse is not true. Note that these slaughter rules are skin-in-the-game driven, inherited from the ancient Eastern Mediterranean Greek and Levantine practice of economically burdensome animal sacrifice, to only worship the gods if one has skin in the game. The gods do not like cheap signaling. Now consider this manifestation of the dictatorship of the minority. In the United Kingdom, where the practicing Muslim population is only 3 to 4%, a very high proportion of the meat we find is halal. Close to 70% of lamb imports from New Zealand are halal. Close to 10% of Subway stores carry halal-only meat, meaning no pork, in spite of the high costs of losing the business of ham-eaters, like myself. The same holds in South Africa, which has about the same proportion of Muslims. There, a disproportionately high share of chicken is halal certified. But in the UK and other nominally Christian countries, halal is not neutral enough to reach a high level, as people may rebel against being forced to abide by others' sacred values. Accepting and respecting the sacred values of other religions might signal some type of violation of yours if you are a true monotheist. For instance, the 7th century Christian Arab poet Al-Aktal made a point to never eat halal meat in his famous defiant poem boasting his Christianity, "I do not eat sacrificial flesh." Wa lasta biakolla lamu udahe. Al-Aktal was reflecting a standard Christian reaction from 3 or 4 centuries earlier. Christians were tortured in pagan times by being forced to eat sacrificial meat, which they found sacrilegious. Many Christian martyrs took the heroic stance of starving to death rather than ingest impure food. One can expect the same rejection of others' religious norms to take place in the West as the Muslim populations in Europe grow. So the minority rule may produce a larger share of halal food in the stores than warranted by the proportion of halal eaters in the population, but with a headwind somewhere because some people may have a taboo against the custom. But with some non-religious kashrut rules, so to speak, the share can be expected to converge closer to a 100%, or some high number. In the U.S. and Europe, organic food companies are selling more and more products precisely because of the minority rule, and because ordinary and unlabeled food may be seen by some to contain pesticides, herbicides, and transgenic genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, with, according to them, unknown risks. What we call GMOs in this context means transgenic food, entailing the transfer of genes from a foreign organism or species that would not have occurred in nature. Or it could be for some existential reasons, cautious behavior, or Burkean conservatism, that is, following the precautionary ideas of Edmund Burke. Some may not want to venture too far too fast from what their grandparents ate. Labeling something organic is a way to say that it contains no transgenic GMOs. In promoting genetically modified food via all manner of lobbying, purchasing of congressmen, and overt scientific propaganda, with smear campaigns against such persons as yours truly, much about which later, big agricultural companies foolishly believed that all they needed was to win the majority. No, you idiots. Your snap scientific judgment is too naive for these types of decisions. Consider that transgenic GMO eaters will eat non-GMOs, but not the reverse. So it may suffice to have a tiny percentage, say no more than 5%, of an evenly spatially distributed population of non-genetically modified eaters for the entire population to have to eat non-GMO food. How? Say you have a corporate event, a wedding, or a lavish party to celebrate the fall of the Saudi Arabian regime, the bankruptcy of the rent-seeking investment bank Goldman Sachs, or the public reviling of Ray Kotcher, chairman of Ketchum, the contemptible public relations firm, the enemy of scientists and scientific whistleblowers. Do you need to send a questionnaire asking people if they eat or don't eat transgenic GMOs and reserve special meals accordingly? No. You just select everything non-GMO. Provided the price difference is not consequential. And the price difference appears to be small enough to be negligible, as perishable food costs in America are largely, up to about 80 or 90%, determined by distribution and storage, not the cost at the agricultural level. And as organic food is in higher demand, thanks to the minority rule, distribution costs decrease and the minority rule ends up accelerating in its effect. Big Ag, the large agricultural firms, does not realize that this is the equivalent of entering a game in which one needed to not just win more points than the adversary, but win 97% of the total points just to be safe. It is strange to see an industry that spends hundreds of millions of dollars on research comb smear campaigns, with hundreds of these scientists who think of themselves as more intelligent than the rest of us, miss such an elementary point about asymmetric choices. Another example. Do not think that the spread of automatic shifting cars is necessarily due to a majority preference. It could just be because those who can drive manual shifts can always drive automatic, but the reverse is not true. The method of analysis employed here is called a renormalization group, a powerful apparatus in mathematical physics that allows us to see how things scale up or down. Let us examine it next, without mathematics. Renormalization group. Imagine four boxes exhibiting what is called fractal self-similarity. Each box contains four smaller boxes. Each one of the four boxes will contain four boxes, and so all the way down and all the way up until we reach a certain level. There are two shades, light for the majority choice and dark for the minority one. Assume the smaller unit contains four people, a family of four. One of them is in the intransigent minority and eats only non-GMO food, which includes organic. The color of this box is dark, and the other's light. We renormalize once as we move up. The stubborn daughter manages to impose her rule on the four, and the unit is now all dark, i.e. will opt for non-GMO. Now, step three. You have the family going to a barbecue party attended by three other families. As they are known to only eat non-GMO, the guests will cook only organic. The local grocery store, realizing the neighborhood is only non-GMO, switches to non-GMO to simplify life, which impacts the local wholesaler, and the system continues to renormalize. By some coincidence, the day before the Boston barbecue, I was flaneuring in New York, and I dropped by the office of Raphael Doady, a friend I wanted to prevent from working, that is, engaging in an activity that, when abused, causes the loss of mental clarity, in addition to bad posture and loss of definition and facial features. The French physicist Serge Galam happened to be visiting, and chose the friend's office to kill time and taste Raphael's bad espresso. Galam was first to apply these renormalization techniques to social matters and political science. His name was familiar, as he is the author of the main book on the subject, which had then been sitting for months in an unopened Amazon box in my basement. He elaborated on his research and showed me a computer model of elections by which it suffices for some minority to exceed a certain level for its choices to prevail. So the same illusion exists in political discussions, spread by political scientists. You think that because some extreme right or left-wing party has, say, the support of 10% of the population, their candidate will get 10% of the votes. No. These baseline voters should be classified as inflexible and will always vote for their faction. But some of the flexible voters can also vote for that extreme faction, just as non-kosher people can eat kosher. These people are the ones to watch out for, as they may swell the number of votes for the extreme party. Galam's models produced a bevy of counterintuitive effects in political science, and his predictions have turned out to be way closer to real outcomes than the naive consensus. The veto. What we saw in the renormalization group was the veto effect, as a person in a group can steer choices. The advertising executive, an extremely bon vivant, Rory Sutherland, suggested to me that this explains why some fast food chains, such as McDonald's, thrive. It's not because they offer a great product, but because they are not vetoed in a certain socioeconomic group, and by a small proportion of people in that group at that. To put it in technical terms, it was a best-worst-case divergence from expectations, a lower variance and lower mean. When there are few choices, McDonald's appears to be a safe bet. It is also a safe bet in shady places with few regulars, where the food variance from expectation can be consequential. I am writing these lines in the Milan train station, and, as offensive as it can be to someone who spent all this money to go to Italy, McDonald's is one of the few restaurants there, and it is packed. Shockingly, Italians are seeking refuge there from a risky meal. They may hate McDonald's, but they certainly hate uncertainty even more. Pizza is the same story. It is a commonly accepted food, and, outside a gathering of pseudo-leftist caviar eaters, nobody will be blamed for ordering it. Rory wrote to me about the beer-wine asymmetry and the choices made for parties. Once you have 10% or more women at a party, you cannot serve only beer. But most men will drink wine, so you only need one set of glasses if you serve only wine, the universal donor, to use the language of blood groups. This strategy of seeking the optimal among not necessarily great options might have been played by the Khazars when they were looking to choose between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Legend has it that three high-ranking delegations, bishops, rabbis, and sheikhs, came to make the sales pitch. The Khazar lords asked the Christians, "If you were forced to choose between Judaism and Islam, which one would you pick?" "Judaism," they replied. Then the lords asked the Muslims, "Which of the two, Christianity or Judaism?" "Judaism," the Muslims said. Judaism it was, and the tribe converted. Lingua franca. If a meeting is taking place in Germany in the Teutonic-looking conference room of a corporation that is sufficiently international or European, and one of the persons in the room doesn't speak German, the entire meeting will be run in English, the brand of inelegant English used in corporations across the world. That way, they can equally offend their Teutonic ancestors and the English language. It all started with the asymmetric rule that those who are non-native in English know bad English, but the reverse, English speakers knowing other languages, is less likely. French was supposed to be the language of diplomacy, as civil servants coming from aristocratic backgrounds used it, while their more vulgar compatriots involved in commerce relied on English. In the rivalry between the two languages, English won as commerce grew to dominate modern life. The victory has nothing to do with the prestige of France or the efforts of their civil servants in promoting their more or less beautiful Latinized and logically spelled language over the orthographically confusing one of trans-channel meat pie eaters. We can thus get some inkling of how the emergence of lingua francas can come from minority rules, and that is a point that is not visible to linguists. Aramaic is a Semitic language that succeeded the Canaanite language, that is, Phoenician Hebrew, in the Levant, and resembles Arabic. It was the language Jesus Christ spoke. The reason it came to dominate the Levant and Egypt isn't because of any particular imperial Semitic power or the fact that they have interesting noses. It was the Persians, who speak an Indo-European language, who spread Aramaic, the language of Assyria, Syria, and Babylon. Persians taught Egyptians a language that was not their own. Simply, when the Persians invaded Babylon, they found an administration with scribes who could only use Aramaic and didn't know Persian. So Aramaic became the state language. If your secretary can only take dictation in Aramaic, Aramaic is what you will use. This led to the oddity of Aramaic being used in Mongolia, as records were maintained in the Syriac alphabet. Syriac is the eastern dialect of Aramaic. And centuries later, the story would repeat itself in reverse, with the Arabs using Greek in their early administration in the 7th and 8th centuries. For during the Hellenistic era, Greek replaced Aramaic as the lingua franca in the Levant, and the scribes of Damascus maintained their records in Greek. But it was not the Greeks who spread Greek around the Mediterranean, but the Romans who accelerated the spreading of Greek, as they used it in their administration across the Eastern Empire, as well as the coastal Levantines. The New Testament was written in the Greek of Syria. A French-Canadian friend from Montreal, Jean-Louis Rayot, bemoaning the loss of the French language among French Canadians outside narrowly provincial areas, commented as follows. In Canada, when we say bilingual, it is English-speaking, and when we say French-speaking, it becomes bilingual. Genes versus languages. Looking at genetic data in the Eastern Mediterranean with my collaborator, the geneticist Pierre Zalua, we noticed that both invaders, Turks and Arabs, left few genes, and in the case of Turkey, the tribes from East and Central Asia brought an entirely new language. Turkey, shockingly, is still inhabited by the populations of Asia Minor you read about in history books, but with new names. Further, Zalua and his colleagues claim that Canaanites from 3,700 years ago represent more than nine-tenths of the genes of current residents of the state of Lebanon, with only a tiny amount of new genes added, in spite of about every possible army having dropped by for sightseeing and some pillaging. There is also a current controversy in the United Kingdom, as the Normans left more texts and pictures in history books than genes there. While Turks are Mediterraneans who speak an East Asian language, the French, north of Avignon, are largely of Northern European stock, yet they speak a Mediterranean language. So, genes follow majority rule, languages minority rule. Languages travel, genes less so. This shows us the recent mistake of building racial theories on language, dividing people into Aryans and Semites based on linguistic considerations. While the subject was central to the German Nazis, the practice continues today in one form or another, often benign. For the great irony is that Northern European supremacists, Aryan, while anti-Semitic, used the classical Greeks to give themselves a pedigree and a link to a glorious civilization, but didn't realize that the Greeks and their Mediterranean Semitic neighbors were actually genetically close to one another. It has been recently shown that both ancient Greeks and Bronze Age Levantines share an Anatolian origin. It just happened that the languages diverged. The One-Way Street of Religions. In the same manner, the spread of Islam in the Near East, where Christianity was heavily entrenched, remember that it was born there, can be attributed to two simple asymmetries. The original Islamic rulers weren't particularly interested in converting Christians, as these provided them with tax revenues. The proselytism of Islam did not initially address those called people of the book, i.e., individuals of Abrahamic faith. In fact, my ancestors who survived 13 centuries under Muslim rule saw clear advantages in not being Muslim, mostly in the avoidance of military conscription. The two asymmetric rules are as follows. First, under Islamic law, if a non-Muslim man marries a Muslim woman, he needs to convert to Islam. And if either parent of a child happens to be Muslim, the child will be Muslim. There are some minor variations across regions and Islamic sects. The original rule is that if a Muslim woman marries a non-Muslim man, he needs to convert. But in practice, in many countries, both need to do so. Second, becoming Muslim is irreversible, as apostasy is the heaviest crime under the religion, sanctioned by the death penalty. The famous Egyptian actor Omar Sharif, born Michel Dimitri Shaloub, came from a Lebanese Christian family. He converted to Islam to marry a famous Egyptian actress and had to change his name to an Arabic one. He later divorced, but did not revert to the faith of his ancestors. Under these two asymmetric rules, one can do simple simulations and see how a small Islamic group occupying Christian, Coptic, Egypt can lead, over the centuries, to the Copts becoming a tiny minority. All one needs is a small rate of interfaith marriages. Likewise, one can see how Judaism doesn't spread and tends to stay in the minority, as the religion has weaker rules. The mother is required to be Jewish. An even stronger asymmetry than that of Judaism explains the depletion in the Near East of three Gnostic faiths, the Druze, the Yazidi, and the Mandeans. Gnostic religions are those with mysteries and knowledge that are typically accessible to only a minority of elders, with the rest of the members kept in the dark about the details of the faith. Unlike Islam, which requires either parent to be Muslim, and Judaism, which asks for at least the mother to have the faith, these three religions require both parents to be of the faith. Otherwise, the child and the parents say toodaloo to the community. In places such as Lebanon, Galilee, and northern Syria, with mountainous terrain, Christians and other non-Sunni Muslims remained concentrated. Christians, not being exposed to Muslims, experienced no intermarriage. By contrast, Egypt has a flat terrain. The distribution of the population presents homogeneous mixtures there, which permits renormalization, i.e., allows the asymmetric rule to prevail. Egypt's Copts suffered from an additional problem, the irreversibility of Islamic conversions. Many Copts during Islamic rule converted to the dominant religion when it was merely an administrative procedure, something that helps one land a job or handle a problem that requires Islamic jurisprudence. One did not have to really believe in it, since Islam doesn't conflict markedly with Orthodox Christianity. Little by little, a Christian or Jewish family engaging in a Morano-style conversion becomes truly converted, as, a couple of generations later, the descendants forget the arrangement of their ancestors. So all Islam did was out-stubborn Christianity, which itself won thanks to its own stubbornness. For before Islam, the original spread of Christianity in the Roman Empire was largely due to the blinding intolerance of Christians, their unconditional, aggressive, and recalcitrant proselytizing. Roman pagans were initially tolerant of Christians, as the tradition was to share gods with other members of the empire. But they wondered why these Nazarenes didn't want to give and take gods and offer that Jesus fellow to the Roman pantheon in exchange for some other gods. What, our gods aren't good enough for them? But Christians were intolerant of Roman paganism. The persecution of the Christians had vastly more to do with the intolerance of the Christians for the pantheon of local gods than the reverse. What we read is history written by the Christian side, not the Greco-Roman one. We know too little about the Roman perspective during the rise of Christianity, as hagiographies have dominated the discourse. We have, for instance, the narrative of the martyr Saint Catherine, who kept converting her jailers until she was beheaded, except that she may have never existed. But the beheading of Saint Cyprian, Bishop of Carthage, under Valerian, was real. So there are endless histories of Christian martyrs and saints, but very little is known of pagan heroes. Even the early Christians of the Gnostic tradition have been expurgated from the record. When Julian the Apostate tried to go back to ancient paganism, it was like trying to sell French food in South Jersey. It simply had no market. It was like trying to keep a balloon under water. And it was not because pagans had an intellectual deficit. In fact, my heuristic is that the more pagan, the more brilliant one's mind, and the higher one's ability to handle nuances and ambiguity. Purely monotheistic religions, such as Protestant Christianity, Salafi Islam, or fundamentalist atheism, accommodate literalist and mediocre minds that cannot handle ambiguity. It is a fact that while Christianity eradicated previous records, it may also have eradicated its own history. For we are discovering that branches such as the Gnostics had a quite different record of the early religion. But the Gnostics were largely a secret religion, closed to outsiders and secret about their own records. And secret religions, well, bury their secrets. In fact, we can observe in the history of Mediterranean religions, or rather rituals and systems of behavior and belief, a drift dictated by the intolerant, actually bringing the system closer to what we can call a religion. Judaism might have almost lost because of the mother rule and its confinement to a tribal base, but Christianity ruled, and for the very same reasons Islam did. Islam? There have been many Islams, the final accretion quite different from the earlier ones. For Islam itself is ending up being taken over, in the Sunni branch, by purists simply because they are more intolerant than the rest. The Wahhabis, a.k.a. Salafis, founders of Saudi Arabia, destroyed the shrines in most parts of what is now their country during the 19th century. They went on to impose the maximally intolerant rule in a manner that was later imitated by ISIS. Every single accretion of Salafism seems to exist to accommodate the most intolerant of its branches. Decentralize, again. Another attribute of decentralization, and one that the intellectuals opposing an exit of Britain from the European Union, Brexit, don't get. If one needs, say, a 3% threshold in a political unit for the minority rule to take its effect, and on average the stubborn minority represents 3% of the population, with variations around the average, then some states will be subject to the rule, but not others. If, on the other hand, we merge all states in one, then the minority rule will prevail all across. This is the reason the USA works so well. As I have been repeating to everyone who listens, we are a federation, not a republic. To use the language of Anti-Fragile, decentralization is convex to variations. Imposing virtue on others. This idea of one-sidedness can help us debunk a few more misconceptions. How do books get banned? Certainly not because they offend the average person. Most persons are passive and don't really care, or don't care enough to request the banning. From past episodes, it looks like all it takes is a few motivated activists for the banning of some books, or the blacklisting of some people. The great philosopher and logician Bertrand Russell lost his job at the City University of New York owing to a letter by an angry and stubborn mother who did not wish to have her daughter in the same room as the fellow with the dissolute lifestyle and unruly ideas. The same seems to apply to prohibitions, at least to the prohibition of alcohol in the United States, which led to interesting mafia stories. Let us conjecture that the formation of moral values in society doesn't come from the evolution of the consensus. No, it is the most intolerant person who imposes virtue on others precisely because of that intolerance. The same can apply to civil rights. An insight into how the mechanisms of religion and the transmission of morals obey the same renormalization dynamics as dietary laws, and how we can show that morality is more likely to be something enforced by a minority. We saw earlier in the chapter the asymmetry between obeying and breaking rules. A law-abiding or rule-abiding fellow always follows the rules, but a felon or someone with looser sets of principles will not always break the rules. Likewise, we discussed the strong asymmetric effects of halal dietary laws. Let us merge the two. It turns out that, in classical Arabic, the term halal has one opposite, haram. Violating legal and moral rules, any rule, is called haram. It is the exact same interdict that governs food intake and all other human behaviors, like sleeping with the wife of your neighbor, lending with interest, without partaking of downside of the borrower, or killing one's landlord for pleasure. Haram is haram and is asymmetric. Once a moral rule is established, it will suffice to have a small, intransigent minority of geographically distributed followers to dictate a norm in society. The sad news is that one person looking at mankind as an aggregate may mistakenly believe that humans are spontaneously becoming more moral, better, and more gentle, with better breath, when this applies to only a small proportion of mankind. But things work both ways, the good and the bad. While some believe that the average Pole was complicit in the liquidation of Jews, the historian Peter Frigge, when asked why didn't the Poles in Warsaw help their Jewish neighbors more, responded that they generally did. But it took 7 or 8 Poles to help one Jew. It took only one Pole, acting as an informer, to turn in a dozen Jews. Even if such select anti-Semitism is contestable, we can easily imagine bad outcomes stemming from a minority of bad agents. Stability of the minority rule, a probabilistic argument. Wherever you look across societies and histories, you tend to find the same general moral laws prevailing, with some, but not significant, variations. Do not steal, at least not from within the tribe. Do not hunt orphans for entertainment. Do not gratuitously beat up Spanish grammar specialists for training. Instead, use boxing bags. Unless you are Spartan, and even then you can only kill a limited number of helots for training purposes, and similar interdicts. And we can see these rules evolved over time to become more universal, expanding to a broader set, to progressively include slaves, other tribes, other species, animals, economists, etc. And one property of these laws, they are black and white, binary, discrete, and allow no shadow. You cannot steal a little bit or murder moderately, just as you cannot keep kosher and eat just a little bit of pork at Sunday barbecues. I don't think that if you fondled the breast of the wife or girlfriend of some random weightlifter in front of him, you would do well in the intervening noisy episode, nor would you be able to